This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be joined by Naomi Wolf, feminist, social critic, and political activist.
Naomi sees what most Americans are blind to, that this country is well on the road to taking 10 steps toward a fascist state.
We'll also hear an update about Blackwater and the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit against them. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we'd like to update our listeners on a few events that have occurred in the last week that we think you should know about. The first one, of course, concerns one of our own hosts, Heidi Boghossian. Heidi Boghossian, by that last name, you may not know it, but is actually half Armenian. And all of a sudden, we've seen a lot of information and news in the media about Armenia and Turkey. You know, none of us really understand what's going on, but it's something to do with genocide, Armenia and Turkey, and the Congress. So, Heidi, why don't you tell our listeners about this new resolution, what's going on with genocide in Armenia?
Well, for decades, the United States government has refused to officially acknowledge, and by that I mean in the history books, on the records, the fact that many years ago, the beginning of the century, the Ottoman Turks massacred the Armenians, killing about 1.5 million, I believe. For Armenian survivors, and there are still many left who came to this country fleeing Armenia during that time, it is really a symbolic and a moral issue that we, this strong country who knows that this in fact happened, has refused to go on the record as acknowledging that it's a fact, so that future generations are aware of the atrocity. In fact, an atrocity that Hitler referred to when he said, "Who will remember the Armenians?" We feel, and I speak for not only Armenians, but I think most people in this country who believe that such atrocities must be on the record historically in order to prevent this from happening again, that it's long overdue to officially recognize the genocide. And why this is important now is that we've come closer, I think, than ever to passing a resolution acknowledging the genocide. And as people who've been reading the newspapers will know, the Turks have been outraged, applying enormous political pressure to the Bush administration to not let this pass.
And what always has struck me as odd about the Turks, this genocide happened prior to the current Turkish administration, the Ataturk administration, which took power, I guess, after
1915. And there had been some activity before.
But the genocide took place before Ataturk and the modern Turkish Republic. It was under the Ottoman Empire.
Exactly.
And so I sort of just don't get it.
I think it's a legacy of shame, that it's an embarrassment for modern Turks to recognize that even though it didn't happen under the current situation, this is something that is condemned all around the world. It's an embarrassment to them. But we know it hasn't been perpetrated by the current Turkish administration, and we'd just like to set the record straight for future generations.
So why can't Congress get this legislation through?
Well, we had a significant victory. It passed in the House last week.
The House Committee.
It passed in the House Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Immediately, we saw outrage from Turkish leaders. President Bush going on the record as saying literally that this government is going to pressure others not to let this pass. And in fact,
The U.S. government is going to pressure Congress
to not let it pass because, as the government says, provoke the Turks and ruin our chances for military support for the invasion of Iran.
And Turkey has already withdrawn its ambassador, or at least called its ambassador back for consultations because they're so angry. And of course, the U.S. has not only the invasion of Iran potentially, but of course, we have a big military base in Iraq, which is a staging area for really a lot of what we do in the Middle East.
Exactly. And so, as you can well imagine, Bush will let this happen over his dead body, as it were.
Well, in fact, we've already been reading, now that the Foreign Affairs Committee had its vote in the House, that there's Democrats and some Republicans now are pulling back from the resolution, saying this is not, we think this is maybe a bad idea, it's not the right time to do it.
Exactly.
The question is, what's the right time to do something?
Yeah, it's never been the right time. The one positive thing that I see coming out of this is greater awareness of the Armenian genocide. You know that several authors have written about, I think, survivors and children of genocide survivors from Armenia have written a lot about a kind of shameful feeling that a lot of Armenians have about being associated with the genocide. I know, for example, my father never spoke about it, and my grandmother came over.
Your grandmother was alive then, right?
She was alive. She saw her family literally being massacred.
Wow.
She escaped. She went to an orphanage and then was a mail order bride. My grandfather escaped and paid for her passage. And she would cry whenever it was mentioned. I think it's important for survivors, both of Armenians and others who don't want this repeated, to know that it's a part of the past. It's not a part of the present. But if we don't bring it out into the open, it will be forgotten, especially as Armenians who were part of it die.
What's remarkable to me in all these issues, and we'll get to another one soon when we talk about the American Indian movement and Vernon Belcourt and use of Indian logos, is how much politics is at play. Because here you have the Armenian community, which is not a powerful community, trying to get some recognition about what happened to them. And of course, we have a very powerful Jewish community. And if you can imagine what would break loose if Congress was held back on any kind of legislation regarding the Holocaust or calling that or not calling that a genocide. It would be, I mean, nobody would be elected again or no one would get a nickel. So, and of course, that should be called a genocide, what happened to Jewish people in Europe during the Second World War, but so should the Armenians. And it's just, it's such a political hot potato. Shows how what we label as human rights violations is so involved.
Right.
Often with politics.
Right. To finish what I was going to say, I do think for many people who'd never heard of the Armenians in this country, it's getting front page news. The politics, as you say, are being exposed every day for people to see.
I think that's really important. Right.
So hopefully, I'm hoping that it'll keep the pressure on and we'll get this resolution passed, if not this year, in the next year or two.
Right. Everybody now at least recognizes or more or less recognizes that there was a genocide, and they're basically saying we just can't do this because we've got a military base in Turkey,
right,
and that's going to affect, you know, we're in the middle of this war in the Middle East, then what are we going to do with
it? And it also involves a lot of First Amendment issues, as we've talked about briefly on Law and Disorder. In Turkey, if you mention the Armenian genocide, you're severely punished.
Right. In fact, not only anything to do with Armenia, and you can't speak about the genocide, you can't write about it, you can go to jail.
Right.
Of course, it's like that with the Kurds as well in Turkey.
Yeah.
You know, the Kurds are a big part of the population, and if you talk about or even used to speak the Kurdish language, you could go to jail for that. Turkey, you know, has some serious issues out there, obviously, and of course, we're now looking at a possible invasion by Turks of the Kurdish area of Iran.
Yes.
So we hope that, you know, this will occur, that we will be able to eventually get Congress to do something. But it is amazing what the politics and human rights and their intersection on this issue. Which always brings me to Vernon Belcourt. Vernon Belcourt is an Ojibwe Indian who I knew personally quite well, who just died a week or so ago. And he was one of the early founders of the American Indian Movement, very active on that, which I don't know if people are familiar with, our listeners, with the American Indian Movement, but it was, you know, it was a movement to really regain Indian land and regain Indian rights, and particularly took place in and around Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, that area of Ojibwe Indians, Pine Ridge, that area during the 70s and 80s and even the 60s, to some extent, 70s and 80s. But I knew Vernon partly because he was Ojibwe Indian, raised on the White Earth
reservation, which is where Winona LaDuke is also the reservation in northern Minnesota. And they had a land claim, and I represented the White Earth Band of Chippewa Indians in their in terms of trying to get their land claim back. But then Vernon became really well known for
How did that turn out?
How do most Indian land claims turn out? They wound up with a casino. No, it didn't turn out well. They basically wound up ratifying the takings of Indian land that had taken place over the last 100 years. And so they have a very small land base for a reservation that used to be huge. Mm. And so now they have a private program run by Winona and others to buy back land as it comes on the market. They've probably brought back a few thousand acres so far. So the White Earth Band is beginning to gain some of its land back. But land has always been the basis for really Indian sovereignty and Indian rights, and so that it's an important part of the struggle. But I met Vernon and the other Belcourts during that struggle. And the thing that Vernon became really famous for is his fight against sports teams being named after Indians. So I'm from Cleveland, and we have, of course, one of the grossest logos, the Cleveland Indian, who has this, you know, huge wide smile and, you know, whatever colored skin and certain kind of nose, et cetera, which is a caricature of an Indian.
And I'm from Hanover, New Hampshire, where Dartmouth College has the Indian logo as well, or used to.
Oh, I didn't realize
yes.
that. Yeah, and then, of course, we have all our sports teams and, you know, with various and high school teams with Indian logos, the Warriors, all this kind of stuff. And actually, the Civil Rights Commission issued a rule basically finding this to be a discriminatory way of doing things. Yeah. Vernon led that fight, was key in that fight, and is now, as we're looking at the Cleveland Indians possibly being the American League champions and then possibly the world champions, it should really come up again. Mm-hmm. And there was actually a lawsuit by a National Lawyers Guild lawyer in Cleveland to try and get them to reform the logo. And they actually made some changes, although it's still as gross as you can imagine. They made some changes in the logo.
Both the visual, the logo itself, the image.
Visual. Yeah. And I think there's something that happens, and I have to ask the lawyer, before the first Cleveland Indians game of the season, something to acknowledge something about what happened to Indian peoples. I don't know, but something like that. But it's still on all these logos. And so Vernon Belcourt was a real activist, someone who will be sorely, sorely missed out there in terms of the struggles. But as I said, it relates to the genocide issue in the following way. I once had this idea, and I'm not an artist, but for doing baseball jackets with, instead of having Indians on the side of all of them, having different nationalities on the side of them. Mm-hmm. So you would have, I won't go through it, but you can imagine what you could do. You could have like a caricature of a Jewish person on your jacket and what that would look like, or a caricature of an Italian or a French or an Irish. And you can imagine what the caricatures you could do with them, because each of them has their own stereotype attached to it. And having jackets made like that as a way of bringing home to people
yes.
what it really means to stick a logo of an Indian with the, you know, red skin and a certain kind of nose and, you know, a certain kind of big teeth on a logo.
Right, because so many people say, what's wrong with that? It doesn't even dawn on them. I know that when The Sopranos was on the air, remember, there was an outcry from a group of Italians
right.
about the stereotypes there. But that's an excellent point, because a lot of people have never had such a blatant stereotype branded on a jacket or a product.
I mean, think how an Indian person feels when they see that. Think how an Italian would feel if they had a certain kind of jacket. Think how, you know, whatever the team would be called. It's too gross to even talk
yeah.
about here.
Yeah.
But, so we still have to fight to keep the logos down. There's still those fights go on.
Too many fights.
There was one in the high school upstate New York over that. And the fight was whether they should take the mural off the wall, because it had like some Indian warrior with a tomahawk.
Oh,
and
right.
I think they won it. They actually yeah. got the logo off
yeah.
the wall.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
that's the logo story. And the third little update we want to bring people, and not little, but sort of big actually, is the place where I am the president of and work, the Center for Constitutional Rights, along with a law firm in Philadelphia and a person named Susan Burke, who we work with a lot.
And who's been on this show.
And who Susan has been on the Titan Khaki case. That was a case mm-hmm. against the private interrogation companies in Iraq, who we alleged were involved in the abuse and torture of
the giant companies.
Of people, right.
Yeah.
The new case has been filed against Blackwater, which I'm sure all our listeners are familiar with. It's the private security company that is hired, not hired, but is under some kind of broad contract with the State Department to protect diplomats and others. And there's been lots of complaints about them because they're immune from Iraq law. You can't do anything with them if they violate the law. Some people would argue they're immune even from criminal law under the military code or other criminal law, and they essentially have the ability to be completely lawless.
Right.
And there's been lots of reports about what's
they've done in Iraq. And the suit we brought was regarding an incident that took place in September in which 16 or 17 Iraqis were killed in what is considered to be an unjust, by many people, a completely unjustified shooting. That no shots were fired at the Blackwater security people. They weren't guarding any diplomats at the time, according to witnesses. And they just killed, really, many people would say, in cold blood. Because they have, of course, a presence in the United States, we brought this suit in the United States against Blackwater, all its various affiliates, the owner of Blackwater named Eric Prince. And, of course, I think our listeners are familiar with the book Blackwater by Jeremy Scahill, who was a producer and worked with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! And he is the first book that documented it. So we brought this lawsuit a week or two ago, and it's caused, you know, a huge, actually, outcry against Blackwater. And that suit, congressional hearings, and it now looks like the State Department is thinking of whatever it means to distance themselves from Blackwater or not have them hired anymore. We don't know.
And what exactly are the charges in the lawsuit?
Well, the charges are really two. One is a violation of what we would normally happen if you kill someone in the United States, wrongful death. The people either negligently got killed, or the Blackwater people weren't trained, or they were intentionally killed. And the other is what under international law calls summary execution, which is essentially murder without trial. It's killing someone without a trial. And that's the international law violation. It's a damage case. It's also a case.
So there will be money if you win.
If we win, and hopefully, you know, this case against Blackwater, I think, is a strong one.
Years ago, when we started seeing privatization of services for prisons, other services, it's true these are almost ultra-lawful organizations because the claims against the state, for example, don't apply to contracted services. So that if a corrections officer who's hired by the state does something wrong, he can be liable. But these organizations are exempt.
In Iraq, they're completely exempt. That's correct. I mean, what we're getting at with this lawsuit is not just Blackwater doing some bad things, obviously. You know, that's not the whole purpose. It's really what you're saying, addressing this issue of, in this case, privatization of the use of force and mercenaries. And Naomi Wolf makes the point that this is really our brown shirts, essentially, what were used to really enforce a sort of Führer's law against people in Germany. And there's the potential for this privatization of force to be used like that. And already Jeremy Scahill documented that use in New Orleans.
Well, exactly. I was going to say it's now coming domestically. And how big is Blackwater in the United States?
We don't know.
We just don't know the answers.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know how many people were in New Orleans. There's the other side of this is that they thought that, I think what I've read is that one of the cars that they fired upon, they thought was moving into the intersection and it didn't stop.
Right.
And then they thought, well, maybe it has
attack.
I presume they thought maybe it had a bomb on it. I don't really know. But so far, the witnesses, there were witnesses, Kurdish witnesses, I think, on top of a building that saw it and said they didn't see anybody fire or anything. And that there's also some witnesses that, a witness who said that they even heard that or saw that one of the Blackwater people who said stop firing and they just kept going.
Now, let me ask you this. We've talked about surveillance in this country and listening to conversations perhaps between attorneys and clients, and we know that the center has challenged that. Have there been any special obstacles in terms of this lawsuit communicating with the lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights dealing with this? Have they gone over to Iraq? How do they?
Well, it's an important question. I mean, in our dealings at the center, we deal with a lot of people who the government thinks are terrorists, whether they're Guantanamo or their family's overseas or they've been released and we meet with them overseas. And so we have to assume that everything that we do is wiretapped or electronically surveillanced by the United States, by the Bush administration, and most likely illegally and without a warrant. That's our guess. So in all of our dealings, we just have to assume that. But, you know, there's a certain point we just have to communicate. There is someone in Baghdad who we can communicate with, who can work with us, but essentially there's not many choices here except email and phone. And what that means is that you have to use it, although we have, in the case of Guantanamo, taking actions by having to go to Europe or other places and talk directly with people because we're afraid of having the government's ear in our defense camp, which is what they do. And, of course, that's another update. I mean, they're going on now with this new electronic surveillance legislation and all this. You know, there's a law on the books. The president violated the law. And instead of really doing what Congress should have done, which is investigate and get a prosecution, they basically have been giving him the authority to continue in what would then be legal, but what was formerly a violation of the law. And that's the way it's sadly continuing.
Well, another important case from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we look forward to hearing more updates on that. During our recent fundraiser for Pacifica's WBAI 99.5 in New York City, we were live in the studio with Naomi Wolf. Naomi Wolf is a feminist, social critic, and political activist. The New York Times called her former book, The Beauty Myth, one of the most important books of the 20th century. She is the co-founder of the Woodhull Institute for Ethical Leadership, teaching young women to become leaders and agents of change. Her latest book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, is a call to return to the beliefs of our founding fathers. Her new book illustrates 10 steps historically taken by leaders who are attempting to dismantle a democracy. Wolf jokingly called it the greatest hits of fascism.
Now, Naomi Wolf is here with us in the studio, which is absolutely wonderful. Naomi, I've known of for a very long time, wrote what many people consider one of the most important books of the 20th century, actually, called The Beauty Myth. When was that written, Naomi? I don't remember.
Oh, gosh, I was a baby, 1993.
Well, now I have to give it to my 17-year-old daughter who's going through all these kinds of issues.
Yes, you do.
So The Beauty Myth is one of the great books, really, that talks about, I mean, the way it was written here, it says post-feminism, feminism, but I don't know what that means.
It's all feminism. Yeah.
But anyway, Naomi Wolf wrote that book, which is, as I said, extraordinary. She's the founder of a place called the Woodhull Institute, which is also amazing. Why don't you say a word about that, Naomi?
Sure. It's very wonderful. Like WBAI, it's one of those institutions that, tries to protect civil society when civil society is under threat. And it's an organization that teaches ethical leadership to young people. We have a focus with young women, but we've also had young men. And the idea is to empower young people to essentially helm the heads of arts and media, politics and law, business and entrepreneurship, but engage in ethical decision making. The idea is to run the world with people who actually care about social justice.
Quite remarkable. In fact, the book that Naomi is going to talk about today is called The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. Its cover is a lot like the old Common Sense by Tom Paine, and I'm sure you can talk about that a little bit. But why don't you tell us how you got to write this book and what the sort of point of the book is at this point?
I will. Thank you. And you're absolutely right. There is a real young patriot. His name is Chris Lee. His Vietnamese name was Vu. And I wrote it for him because he was about to marry one of our young graduates. And I realized, because I'd been reading the histories of mid-20th century society's closing, I realized that I didn't just need to give them, something from Crate and Barrel. I needed to give them something that I know you deal with all the time, which is the need for a primer for ordinary citizens, not constitutional scholars, about what is democracy and how to sustain it. What did the founders intend? How does the Bill of Rights actually keep us safe? How does the Constitution protect us? As well as a quick guide to the blueprint. It's essentially a simple blueprint that despots use to close down open societies.
The title is quite provocative because it's The End of America. And so what is the point of that title? I mean, what is it about? Are we really talking about a situation where we could see at least the end of America as we know it?
Yeah. And you'll have to forgive me for being a little bit shell-shocked this morning. I've just come back from a week traveling across the country, really for the first time with this book, talking to audiences about this message. And I almost hoped when I wrote this book that it would be looking ahead to a possible but avertible future that we need to take action about to forestall. But unfortunately, I've really come to realize on this journey across the country that the future is here and the time to rise up is, you know, last week. Yes, I'm talking about the end of America as we know it, meaning the end of liberty, the end of citizens being able to express themselves freely without fear of the state, retribution in some scary way, and America based on the vision that the founding fathers passed down to us, an America of checks and balances. And yes, the end of America is when people really don't understand what a closed society looks like or how a democracy closes. A democracy, history shows, doesn't have to close in a violent coup. A democracy can be closed fairly easily when would-be despots do 10 key things. And while it's happening, it's not overnight. It's incremental. It's not not even a diagonal line where you can say, oh, this is what's happening steadily. It's more like a series of tipping points. And from what I've heard from Americans across the country, and Americans, I want to stress, from all walks of life, Republicans are as freaked out about this in my travels outside the Beltway as Democrats are, is that these tipping points are happening now. Basically, the great dictators of the mid-20th century figured out a blueprint for how to close down a democracy through this series of assaults. And petty dictators kind of, you know, follow the blueprint less spectacularly. I mean, we teach the blueprint at the School for the Americas. And what happens in the blueprint is when a certain point has been reached, it is very hard for democracy to heal democracy. And so we're seeing these assaults right now.
We're with Naomi Wolf, the author of The End of America.
Yeah, can I just chime in? You know, this is so important that your listeners and all their friends and family support you guys. And it's not just the programming. It's so important because it is so clear to me that as we move into this stage of aggressive crackdown against democracy, these islands of free speech are more important than ever. They're at the forefront. But also people like you guys who are leading the fight to restore the rule of law and to let people know what the rule of law looks like are really the heroes and at the forefront.
Naomi, I just want to remind our audience that you've written The End of America. What's interesting to me about this book, a number of things are interesting, but one of the things is that it's published by Chelsea Green Publishing, which published our own Michael Ratner's book. Michael and Ellen Ray did a book on Guantanamo, torture and what's going on at Guantanamo.
Which I drew on heavily, by the way, in my section on torture.
And Chelsea Green is one of those publishing houses that we really have to be grateful to. And they donated a bunch of books for us to give out as premiums here. And secondly, this book is not just a book. It's a book that asks people to do something. It's a book that promotes the American Freedom Campaign. We're going to put up the American Freedom Campaign's website on our website.
Thank you.
Michael, tell us about the American Freedom Campaign, because I know the Center for Constitutional Rights is involved in it.
Yeah, we're happy to be involved in it. I'm going to let Naomi describe it. We haven't gotten to her book yet, but why don't you describe the American Freedom Campaign, what its website is, and tell people what they can do.
Very important. Okay, so we do need... I mean, history shows when there's an aggressive crackdown against democracy that really the only thing to save a country and to save a democracy is an aggressive grassroots democracy movement. And how ironic that we need one in the United States of America right now, but we do. So the American Freedom Campaign is a new organization, not so new by now, a few months old, where very brave people from many key organizations, but also thousands and thousands of grassroots citizens, patriots, have joined together to basically drive an aggressive democracy movement to restore the Constitution and the rule of law, and to hold our lawmakers accountable to doing the minimum to restore the Constitution. And we're honored to have Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights as one of our partner organizations. We have Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Move On. I believe the National Lawyers Guild has just come on. Thank you. They're talking to us. I shouldn't be premature until I have formal confirmation.
There she is, the executive director.
Sounds like a right match to me. Right.
Okay, well, let's chat off the air. But we're reaching out across the spectrum. On the left, there's a parallel organization on the right called the American Freedom Agenda. And what we've got is a 10-point legislative package that you can see on the website. Some of these, I mean, I remember turning to Michael Ratner and saying, if we could turn to the American people and say, what gift could we give you and your brave lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights to help you? He said, what's your wish list? He said, restore habeas corpus. So that's on the 10-point agenda. You know, other key things like keep the government from breaking into our homes, tapping our phones and emails, seizing our computers without a court order on the president's say-so alone, forbid kidnapping, detaining, torturing people, and the abuse of signing statements, prohibit military commissions, and keep journalists from being prosecuted under the Espionage Act for reporting on classified information. I just had a lovely evening with Daniel Ellsberg and his beautiful wife in Berkeley, and he chilled me by saying that the things that the government did to him, like illegal wiretapping, trying to intimidate him with a bunch of thugs, breaking into his shrink's office and stealing, confidential records, those things are legal now. And they led to the impeachment of a president, back when we had a strong democracy. So I guess what I also want to say about this is as I've traveled across the country, people are glad that there's a democracy movement that is coalescing like this. And I do think we're making a difference. We put a pledge to basically protect the Constitution to all the presidential candidates on the Democratic side. And most of them signed up except the front runners, Hillary and Obama. And finally, there was a lot of pressure on them from this campaign. Finally, they signed the pledge, and Hillary moved in her public assertions about torture from a shocking position of, yes, it's okay sometimes, the fake ticking time bomb scenario, to now she's out there saying all torture is wrong. So that's movement. This shows what you can do when you get, you know, millions of Americans or thousands and thousands of Americans pushing. But I mean, what I'm hearing from people is that it's not enough.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We're speaking with social critic and political activist Naomi Wolf about her latest book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot.
When I say I'm a little shell-shocked, you know, I've been traveling across the country and there have been packed crowds. And it's not that I'm so interesting. It's that people know that there's a crisis. And these crowds are across the political spectrum. And they're like, I tell them, well, we have this movement. It's a 10-point agenda. And write your congressman. And they're like, fine, that is not enough. And then, okay, so I'm jumping ahead a little, but it seems clear to me that crimes are being committed, okay? And you guys talked about, and I'm dying to get my hands on this, a lineup of a principled argument about criminality. And again, looking at the historical record, at this point where I'm worried about Blackwater. I mean, I'm moving ahead quite a bit, but Blackwater massacred 17 people in Iraq, and the state is protecting them. This is what you do in Germany. This is what happens in Italy. The state protects the thugs, the murderers, the torturers. And once you cross that line, you know, it doesn't matter how much of civil society is intact because people just get scared. And so Blackwater could be deployed in Times Square tomorrow, as I understand the law. They were already in New Orleans. They've got a $1 billion contract to deploy more widely in the United States.
Let me remind people, we're listening to Naomi Wolf, The End of America, a crucial piece of reading.
Thank you. So to pick up, you know, if their business model calls for expanded deployment in the United States in the event of a natural disaster or, quote unquote, a public emergency. And as of the 2007 Defense Authorization Act, now the president has enhanced powers to declare a public emergency. So this is not happy, looking at the historical blueprint. And our timeline is tighter than I thought it was when I wrote this book. So I guess I want to ask you guys, because you're all lawyers, as I understand it, and I'm not. People are asking me to ask you, how do we prosecute? Because we don't have time.
You know, you prosecute if you have a mass movement behind you and if you have the power behind you.
Is that correct?
Well, as a practical matter.
In this country, it's very difficult, obviously. I mean, what we have done in this country is criminal cases are, you have to go to the prosecutor. So that's a big problem.
Right.
You have to go to impeachment as another route. You can do civil
cases. Can you impeach and then prosecute? Because history shows that it's not enough to impeach. It isn't enough to impeach if you have violent criminals.
Once those two guys are out of office, Bush and Cheney, they can then be prosecuted.
Okay, so the steps to take are impeach, then prosecute. Is that correct?
That's if you want to do it here. That's correct.
Well, how else can one do it?
Now, I will say that in Europe, I just came back from Europe, and it was actually thrilling in a way. I mean, we filed a case in Germany that we lost against Rumsfeld. We're working on one possibly in Spain where there's Guantanamo detainees, and that may stick on torture. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 25 CIA agents have been indicted in Italy, and they're called...
No, I didn't know that.
And they're fugitives.
Whoa!
Alien
fugitives.
And the prosecutor, and I don't generally get along with prosecutors.
We'll give them a trial, though.
The Italian prosecutor was at our meeting and has a slideshow that I'm going to try and bring him here that shows how we track down these agents who kidnap
an Egyptian cleric off the streets of Milan
right.
and sent him to Egypt for torture.
Wow.
They have been indicted. 12 or so agents have been indicted in Germany for the kidnapping of al-Masri, the German citizen who was taken, you know, off a bus in Macedonia and sent to a U.S. torture site in Afghanistan. So Europe now actually, it has some pluses and minuses going on among these issues, but actually there's some things going on. And those agents, this is great to me, Naomi, is those agents, to the extent we have their real names, or the prosecutor does, and he does in a number of cases, they now have arrest warrants out for them in 140 countries.
Oh, my gosh. So, I've never heard this. There's like a news blackout in the U.S. about stuff like that.
Yeah.
Right. The first thing a would-be despot always does, and I want to reassure readers that what I did was I looked at societies where a would-be dictator sought either to close a democracy or to crush a pro-democracy movement. And it didn't matter if the would-be dictator was on the left or the right. It turns out they all do the same 10 things. And by the way, you know, I wrote this book not just for this young man, but for a slightly older family friend who's the daughter of Holocaust survivors. And again, I don't look at Germany lightly. I'm Jewish, and I would not, you know, I'm not using this example rhetorically at all. It's very technical. She is the daughter of Holocaust survivors, and she kept saying to me about news events, they did this in Germany, they did this in Germany. And I thought this was nuts for her to say. And I tried to brush it off, but she forced me to sit down and start reading some histories. And she didn't mean German outcomes, 38, 39. She didn't mean crematoria. She meant the early years, 1930, 31, 32. And people forget, you know, it was a fragile democracy, but it was a modern state with a parliament, a working parliament, a constitution, political parties, newspapers, Bauhaus design, Paris fashion, Page Six, celebrities. It wouldn't have looked so different from us. And people forget that in the early days of what I call a fascist shift, things look pretty normal. I realized that she was not wrong, that there were so many echoes, not just tactics, but actual legislation, actual sound bites, actual images being reproduced. It's almost like someone in the White House looked at the early years, you know, the greatest hits of fascism and totalitarianism, what worked, you know, and is recycling
the same words.
The first part of the book, right, is what you said is not the deepest part, which it isn't, but goes through some of the language, which is extraordinary.
It's shocking.
I mean, Homeland.
Homeland. I mean, there are things we're hearing now that are right out of the 1930s, sleeper cells. Okay, so let me get to the first point. So every would-be dictator invokes a terrifying internal and external threat, and often it can be a real threat, which is hyped. For example, Stalin terrified Soviet citizens by talking about sleeper cells. Again, a term we didn't hear in the Clinton administration, even though al-Qaeda was active in the Clinton administration. Sleeper cells, in Stalin's terms, were capitalist terrorists, us, basically, dressed like good Soviet citizens who were going to hide among good Soviet citizens till at a signal years later they would rise up and create terrorist mayhem. So this was fake, but it scared Soviet citizens. And Pinochet later, in 1973, invoked a real threat, armed insurgents. There were armed insurgents. But then he used fake documents, what he called Plan Z, which he showed on television, purporting to be documents about, again, a terror plot where these guys would rise up and bomb infrastructure, assassinate leaders. And we've seen false documents, very common to use false documents in a hyped threat, with a panorama, yellow cake, fake documentation of this alleged uranium arms sale in Niger that was used by the White House to drive us into war. That's number one. The second thing a would-be despot always does is, and this is where talking to Michael Ratner has chilled me to bits, but so has the historical record. You create a secret prison system where torture takes place that's outside the rule of law, and often they create a military tribunal system that strips prisoners of due process. Lenin was the innovator. Mussolini looked at Lenin. These guys all studied each other. Stalin studied Hitler. Hitler studied Stalin. So, you know, Mussolini had the Confino system. Hitler had the people's courts. And what happens, why should we care about that? I mean, apart from the moral issue that we should care. A lot of decent Americans are like, whatever, that's not my issue that they're torturing these alleged terrorists in Guantanamo. And by the way, don't believe the White House soundbite that we don't torture. It's torture. What they're doing is straight out of the Soviet gulag. I mean, these are techniques that were perfected in the Soviet gulag. What happens is that in a fascist shift, the state will start by torturing and abusing prisoners that most people don't identify with. brown people on an island with scary Muslim names, right? Or in the early 30s, it was when torture was still technically illegal and the National Socialists weren't even a dominant power yet, the SA had these makeshift torture cellars, and they took people that Germans were like, whatever, homosexuals, Jews, gypsies, whatever, anarchists, communists, whatever. And people knew about the torture. It was in cartoons. They were like, whatever.
For us to use, because we're really, what we're talking about is social change here. Mm. If you don't have democratic rights, you're not going to get social change.
That's right.
And
in either direction.
You know, just hypothetically say the United States and Israel starts bombing Iran 6 months from now. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge pouring out in all the major cities in America of an anti-war protest. Mm-hmm. And let's say there are 3 million people in New York and Washington combined. And what's the government going to do about this? Well, in the past, they've just hunkered down and eventually give up and withdraw out of Vietnam. But maybe this time they're not going to do that. Mm. Maybe this time they pick up the phone and they call Eric Prince and they say, Prince, let's get some troops in
right.
here. Mm-hmm. We got a national emergency.
That's exactly
and maybe
right.
they invoke that law. Naomi, you talk about it. They actually have a detention center that's set up. They gave one of the big contractors, Kellogg, Brown and Root, division of Halliburton, $377 million to build the detention center in the event of a national emergency. And then they said, and it's not just for illegal immigrants. You know, who do you think they're talking about here? This station, they could pull the plug on this. They've already gotten the big internet companies on board. If we're communicating with each other to try to build the movement, they can turn the switch off. Mm-hmm. So I can't send a message over to Michael at AOL.
I just want to say, this kind of what if, it sounds kind of alarmist in a way, but it's so important to play out these scenarios, because there's a section at the end of the book where I play out a number of these what ifs, all of them very probable based on the historical blueprint or plausible. The reason to play them out now and act to prevent them is that history shows that when there's this kind of sustained assault against democracy, suddenly things start to happen very, very quickly. And there's a kind of shock that sets in, and there's a kind of hangover. And that's really where we are now, because look at Congress. Congress keeps acting like it's a democracy, and the White House is just ignoring them. And this reminds me of this scene where Mussolini has already sent his black shirts to march on Rome. And Parliament is still trying to negotiate with him. They keep offering him cabinet positions. And he's just like drumming his fingers, waiting for them to realize that the time for negotiating is over. So we've got to kind of wake up, because this hangover period is very dangerous. And we have to put in place the basics of the rule of law to prevent these kinds of what-if scenarios.
Now, give your website, Naomi.
Okay, AmericanFreedomCampaign.org. So the third step is, yes, we talked about it, Blackwater, is to create a paramilitary force that's not answerable to the people. Now, why were the founders so concerned about the Second Amendment? And why did they say you can't have a standing army, you can't have a militia that's not answerable to the people? They had just come out of occupation by a hostile force where there was a standing army, where King George's men would break into their homes, go through their stuff. This is why blanket warrants are bad. This is what King George's men used to, terrify the colonists, frighten their families. You know, women were molested and raped. You know, with a standing army, people get traumatized and intimidated very easily. And so they said, you can't have that. So with the 2007 Defense Authorization Act, apart from Blackwater being deployed, we've got a situation where now, totally in violation of what the founders envisioned, totally in violation of how they set us up to be free, the president can send the National Guard from Alabama to enforce a curfew on the people of New York or Oregon over the objections of the governors of Alabama and New York or Oregon, a federalized National Guard in effect, and tell Congress about it after the fact. So this is not what the founders meant when they said you can't have a standing army that terrifies the people.
I think it accelerated under Bush. I think it was a fantasy of Cheney and Addington going all the way back to the 70s. Huh. But I think it's been accruing, and I think it really accelerated after 9/11, when their program was handed to them on a silver platter. But, one chilling thought is, could start a war against Iran without Congress stopping them? Because Congress already said, if you want to do it, go ahead and do it. And the Democrats enabled them to do that. They've been kind of the handmaiden to the Republicans on this. And Congress, which is supposed to declare war, which is like the ultimate crunch in a society,
yeah.
hasn't declared a war since World War II.
Right.
Michael went to court on Congress's sitting on their hands when the executive under Reagan went to war in Central America several times, and Congress just let him do it.
Shocking.
So I think democracy has been kind of slipping away from us since the late 1700s, but it's on a fast track now.
Yeah. And again, once you get these violent, precipitating moments, you know, it's one of those tipping points where there's no turning back. I mean, according to the historical blueprint, which is quite predictive, readers of The End of America can foresee what, you know, what's coming in the next 3 months or 6 months based on the blueprint. For instance, when there was the U.S. attorney scandal and it was just like 8 or 9 U.S. attorneys, I was reading Goebbels. So I was like, okay, I bet they tried to purge all the U.S. attorneys. And sure enough, the emails they're not providing will show that they did try to purge all the U.S. attorneys, which is a tactic, which is a tactic that Goebbels perfected in April of 1933, focusing especially on lawyers and judges. And petty despots have, you know, imitated that ever since, because you don't have to have a coup if you purge the civil service and you purge the lawyers and you restock them all with your cronies. Because in a close election, it would be the end of America if they had gotten away with that, because the U.S. attorneys are the ones who prosecute voter fraud.
And they've been able to do that with the courts, unfortunately. Yeah. They have staffed them very much like that.
We're very grateful to have Naomi Wolf with us. She's written The End of America. It talks about historical echoes, Italy or Germany, when their economy, their capitalist economy, collapsed. Mm. And those who were running the show wanted to make sure they weren't going to slip out of power. What kind of closed society did they create? Mm. And Naomi shows the parallel between what happened in Germany and what is going on here. I don't mean to be alarmist, but that's precisely what's going on here. And Naomi, pick up on that discussion, because we've been sharing some of the nuggets from your book.
Yeah. And, you know, I just want to stress, it doesn't have to be a right-wing dictator. I talked about Germany and Italy, but I also look at East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, China's crackdown on the democracy movement in the 80s. It's any would-be despot. So, and I have to also say, sadly, I would love to think that these dangers just take place in fragile economies, but the amazing thing about what's going on now, it's kind of historically unprecedented, is in a strong, stable, peaceful America, these people have been systematically disemboweling democracy just by using fear.
Maybe they know something we don't know in terms of their grip on the world and the economy and where it's going. I think it may have the appearance of being strong and stable now, but I'm not sure that, you know, if we had this discussion 2 years from now, looking back at it, this economy is going to be strong, stable, and healthy. I'm not sure about that. Maybe, you know, what must they have been thinking when Cheney met with the heads of all the oil companies and I think laid the plans for attacking Iraq? I think they were saying, we got to control the oil because, you know, the China's going to be a problem and India's going to be a problem and our position in the world could be shrinking.
Yeah, so but unfortunately, it's more evil than that, I think. I mean, I do. I'm sorry to say this.
Okay, lay it on us.
Well, I will. I will, and it goes to the work that, I mean, I just want to, like, confess that the Center for Constitutional Rights, they're like my personal heroes, because they are. They were protecting the rights of the most reviled, you know, and facing death threats at a time when no one else would do it. And if more people had done that in Germany, according to Richard Evans, the historian, it could, like, you know, history could have turned out very, very differently. So here's what happened. When the Cold War ended and we lost the Soviet Union as a global enemy, the third of the economy that was making Cold War weaponry was facing a radically declining market share. And so what is more necessary than to have an enemy to replace the Soviet Union? I think it's notable that those same weapons manufacturers have shifted in the last few years from Cold War weapons manufacturing to manufacturing what a source at the CIA has described as the military surveillance complex and the military the security industrial complex. And these people have lobbyists with close ties to Homeland Security, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry. So to keep that going, you really need an enemy. And to keep it going, you really need to turn basically us into the enemy, to create a surveillance society. I mean, look at their front page stories in the New York Times about how Wall Street is investing in the police state in China because there's billions to be made in surveilling billions of citizens.
That's great.
I just want to throw out something really creepy, like along these lines. So I sometimes think about this, and it really gives me nightmares, but I don't think evil is ever this conscious. But I think people can justify things unconsciously that are beyond the pale. So if you were to look at Guantanamo or at the U.S.-held prisons and the systematic humiliation, abuse, degradation, it's like they couldn't be creating better fodder to inflame the Muslim world. And the stories get out, and it's videotaped, and the prisoners testify. And I mean, I read things every day that just lift up the hair on my head. Like, I know they smear menstrual blood, or they have smeared menstrual blood on Muslim prisoners because that's a violation of their religious beliefs. So I was just reading the IBM, you know,'s role in the Holocaust, and they were smearing Jews' faces with butter and pork because that was a violation. And
oh,
so you
I
keep,
didn't know
yeah, that. You keep seeing these echoes. So I guess what I would love to not think is, if you had like evil Martians on a planet somewhere saying, well, how can we ensure that the Muslim world hates mm-hmm. us? How can we guarantee an ongoing enemy? You would almost create a factory of abuse, humiliation, torture, degradation. I mean, I just want to throw that out
no,
there.
No, I think that's a really important point. I mean, I think one of the questions I've always had, I get asked, well, if torture doesn't work, why
are they doing it?
And you have some answers in your book. Again, we're talking to Naomi Wolf. The book is The End of America. But I do ask myself, and so sometimes I think they do this in a way to terrorize the Muslim world. But you're giving me you're giving us all a slightly different variation.
There's big bucks in provoking the Muslim world. Yeah. There's
which
big money.
Is to keep
money.
That permanent enemy out there. It's like that guy Goldstein in 1984 that they kept alive so that they would continue to have an enemy.
That's really interesting.
Right. Just like they didn't catch Osama. Torture doesn't give reliable information.
No.
It asserts American power. And it asserts, it has a psychological thing as well. Mm-hmm. I think they do it because they can do it and they want to do it. And as a consequence, it does provoke the Muslim world.
I think not coincidentally, you guys should look at sfgate.com. And again, this is not happy, but we have to face it and do something about it. It's not just Americans who face a really nightmarish scenario if we don't stand up and restore the rule of law and prosecute. It's also the rest of the world because, you know, they're rendering citizens off the streets of Italy and Macedonia now. In an America unconstrained by real democracy at home, they could render an EU citizen off the street in Brussels if they don't like where, you know, what they're doing to U.S. interests or Halliburton's interests or KBR's interests. And I think that it's fascinating to me what Michael was saying about other countries starting to criminalize the United States. But if a thug power is unconstrained, people simply start to fear engaging democratically with the United States. And it took a world war to constrain a thuggish Germany. And what power on earth? I mean, we don't have to save ourselves. We have to save the rest of the world. Because what power on earth could constrain an America unconstrained by the rule of law?
I think that's absolutely critical, what you're saying. Absolutely critical. Because militarily, this is it. We're here.
Yeah.
This is the country that can do it.
Yeah.
And how do you constrain it?
That's right.
You know, this is a very dramatic book for a lot of regular people to hear what you're saying.
Right.
Really dramatic. This is out there. This is stuff that maybe we can say to some people, but that you say it to a lot of people, they're going to say, Naomi, are you just crazy? What are you saying?
Well, you know, Michael, as I think I mentioned, I kind of hoped that I would face resistance. But what is really scaring me is that I've been out there in the heartland talking to independents, Republicans, Democrats, and they are more scared than I am. And partly this is explained by the stories I'm getting. I'm almost scared to open my email these days because what I thought was a fringe argument, you know, a predictive argument, like let's not go any further down this road, as I mentioned, is already dramatically underway. I get emails every day. I'm a military guy. I'm senior in the military. I was critical of the war, and now I'm on the watch list. My 15-year-old son is on the watch list. My 83-year-old mother is on the watch list. Or Jessica Rakoff, she was at the Justice Department, and she said, don't torture John Walker Lind. And she said, make sure his lawyer is present. And then she said her emails were deleted, a criminal complaint was filed against her, and she was referred to the Bar Association. Now she's on the watch list. The head of Code Pink, or a leader of Code Pink, just got turned away at the border. I need to find out more about that.
No, that was amazing. Medea Benjamin, and I think Anne Wright was with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they got turned back.
By whom? By the U.S. or by Canada?
I think by the Canadian. Canada won't let them in.
Why? Yeah. I thought the Canadians
because
were
like peace. Because they were convicted of misdemeanors, I think. And that was for demonstration. That's my last emails were around that issue.
Wow.
But in any case, we're talking to Naomi Wolf, author of The End of America. Give us the last couple of words of what you want people to do, how you can help.
Yeah, so, I mean, step number four we don't have time for, but it is create a surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens. And I am so nervous about the fact that I was on the watch list for a year and a half that before I boarded a flight on my week across the country, I was reading Tara McKelvey's Monstering, which is an excellent account of CIA interrogation practices, and it's based on classified material, and you can get prosecuted for, you know, receiving classified material. And I was so nervous that I put that and a beautiful T-shirt someone had given me about the Guantanamo prisoners saying, "We will not be silenced," in English and in Arabic. Right. I put that in the trash in my hotel room, and I put my book of Guantanamo prisoners poetry, you know, I left it for the maid in the hotel room because I was scared to go through security with these items on my person.
Yeah. It's correct. Yeah, I came back with the biography in German of Murat Kurnaz, which is going to come out in this country in February. And it's great. He's in Guantanamo. It's going to be a very good book. And it has a cover of the people at Guantanamo. I came through customs, and the guy opens my bag, and he says, "What is this? What is this?" You know. So you're right.
Did he let you keep it?
I got to keep that. But the T-shirt, we had the woman who made the T-shirt on our show, and what she had gotten taken off a plane for that T-shirt.
Are you serious?
Right? Oh, yeah.
That's right. I heard about
they
that.
Made the guy, he was wearing the T-shirt, and they made him take that one off and put on another one that the stewardess bought him that said, "I love New York."
Right. That's right. That's what it is.
It's funny till it's scary, and there's a tipping point at which it's scary. So here's what we need to do, you guys. We don't have any time. There is no time. The time is now. Okay, first we have to harass and badger and oppress Congress, because they are criminally craven and compliant right now, to pass this 10-point legislative agenda. We have 130,000 signatures for the pledge. We need 5 million, you know, and we have 5 million members in partner organizations. We need 10 or 20 million. It has to become a majority groundswell. Now, people have been saying to me, what about a strike? I think nothing short of that, based on other democracy movements, is going to be effective. We're talking about November 6th, and Daniel Ellsberg talked about a moratorium, which was effective, one day of everyone not participating, then 2 days, then 3 days, just to indicate to everyone that there are millions of Americans who are going to, the way I'm phrasing it, is sit down for the Constitution, not march, because it's too easy to get confronted by the police if you march, but millions of people, moms, housewives, dads, military guys, mainstream, bring American flags, sit down by the millions in some public place in your community all day on November 6th, after you vote, before you vote, and sit down for the Constitution. Then I think we need to, I'm trying to educate myself now, consulting with lawyers about how do we impeach and prosecute, and whom do we impeach and prosecute, and how, because really it is not safe to leave the country in the hands of these people, you know, until the next election. It's not safe to leave them in power another week. I just want to end by saying, don't be depressed. Don't be depressed. Be energized, because history also shows that bullies are cowards, and that when there is a democracy movement of people in their millions standing up to tyrants and oppressors, there is no power on earth that can stop them, especially now, because our democracy is not concluded. It is weakened, and we have the power to restore it.
Naomi, remind listeners of a website where they can get more information about how to join in on this.
Okay. It's AmericanFreedomCampaign.org, and the discussion about the moratorium is just beginning, and I'll keep people posted on the AFC website, and also I'll link to the Huffington Post and to FireDogLake.com.
That was Naomi Wolf talking about her recent book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.